There have been several hearings in Congress, and they've brought in state treasurers to talk about why this anti-ESG messaging doesn't make sense. Those folks are fiduciaries. You're a state treasurer, and they very much feel like if they don't look at these issues in their portfolios, they are not looking at the long-term interests of their participants, for example, in their pension plan. And I agree with them. So the idea that state treasurers are risking or foregoing their fiduciary duty by assessing long-term systemic risks is nonsense.
Welcome to the Future in Sound podcast. I'm your host, Jen Wilson. This is a podcast where we talk about prioritizing people, planet, and profit. In each episode, we speak with world-leading experts who help us see the future we want and our role in it. This is episode 18, Follow the Money. Quick story. I remember in 2010 when I was doing my master's thesis, I was looking at the corporate response to the Haiti earthquake. My very capable thesis advisor told me one day during a meeting, "Jen, a good place to start in order to understand what the response to the earthquake has been in the past is to follow the money." And that's exactly what I did. I followed the money back to the initial corporate donors to understand what was being built in response to that Haiti earthquake and what their motivations had to do with some of the long-term outcomes of those donations. In the podcast today, we talk about a couple of examples where following the money still has a huge amount of relevance. In some cases, it has to do with the news headlines, asking oneself, where is that headline coming from? What is that political statement around ESG coming from? Who is it that really wants to see that narrative put forward? Follow the money. Now, the other side of following the money is that we also have the opportunity to see actions from those who are really pushing a sustainability agenda as well as a financial value creation agenda. So part of the dream for Rico and other colleagues that work at Rico is how can the impetus behind investment theses be squarely looking at not only fiduciary duty, but also some sustainability outcomes that pair along with that duty. And on this podcast, we have the ideal guest to help us think through how big sums of assets under management can be harnessed for a sustainable future. Lisa Wall was the CEO of USCIF, the Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investment, and the USCIF Foundation from 2006 to February 2023. Members of USCIF represent about $5 trillion in assets under management. USCIF is a collaborative network committed to investment practices that consider environmental, social, and corporate governance criteria to generate long-term competitive financial returns and societal impact. Prior to this, Wall was executive director of the International Women's Media Foundation, director of the first international study of the impact of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and director of the Washington, D.C. Office of Save the Children. Her recognition includes being named to Barron's 20 Most Influential People in ESG Investing and receiving the Forbes Impact Award. Lisa, I'm delighted to have you on the Future in Sound podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here today.
What's really interesting about your background, Lisa, is that you've been involved in sustainable investment since 2006, which is a significantly longer time period than the majority of people who claim to be experts in sustainable investment. I'm just wondering, what are some of the core things that you've seen shift in the past almost two decades?
I think one of the most interesting things is how long I've been at this job in comparison to all of my other jobs. And it's been at least three times longer, really four times longer. in part because the field shifted so many times. And so I was CEO of one institution in a field that was evolving. And so I felt like I had four different CEO jobs over the span of nearly 17 years because the field evolved so many times. And so I feel almost like I was present at the most critical decades of this field. So that was fascinating. Secondly, when I came on, my job was really a narrative job. That's how I would describe it looking back, which was how to make this concept of using investment dollars to try to move forward key environmental social and governance issues. Because it was very much in 2006, something that was still being seen as kind of an outgrowth of the 1970s and kind of this liberal fringe movement, and ignored the kind of really interesting work that was going on, not just in creating portfolios, but in the shareholder engagement that was happening, in the community development, financial institutions that were serving a range of low-income and underserved communities across the country. And it really was a simplification of the field. And I think what we did in the first 10 years was to make clear just how professional, broad, and multifaceted and meaningful the field could be. When I look at where we are now, we've kind of gone from a narrative phase to a more regulatory phase. So right now, I have spent more time in my last 2 years at USCIF working with DOL and the SEC than I ever have, as more regulation started to come out, or a proposal started to come out to help regulate the field. And that in a way is a kind of recognition of the growth and importance. And there were so many transitions in the middle of that. So when I started, sustainable investing really wasn't a word that was being used. Responsible investing wasn't really a word that was being used. Impact investing was definitely not a word that was being used. Mission investing. And so you have all of these new actors. Mission investing is largely used by foundations. Impact investing, I think, is a broader concept now, but originally was kind of direct investments, private equity markets. And so the field has just transformed. The number of assets in the field has grown dramatically. When we did the first trends report, we had about $2 trillion. When we did the report in 2022, we had about $8.4 trillion. So those are all very big changes in the field.
So it sounds like you had four different chapters in your CEO role. And when you started, the amount of assets under management to when you finished your role, that also quadrupled. So very interesting that you had a couple quarters there. So it sounds like we're in the policy phase of the kind of work that USCIF is doing. If we zoom out for a second, when we think about the long-term trends moving forward, say the next 10 years, obviously we have intensifying challenges around climate, equity, equality, a variety of different facets of what ESG symbolizes. And I'm wondering, what are some of the trends that you see going forward?
Well, in a way, one of the trends that I see is almost back to the future. That's what I call it. Because when the field started, I've been reading some of the original documents from the woman who founded Trillium Asset Management and then founded USCIF and also Ceres. And, a lot of that conversation was, how do we use the investment process to have impacts on society? And the conversation in some ways has shifted now to, what are the impacts on the companies, right? It's sort of this materiality 1.0 and a materiality 2.0 debate. You see that playing out in a little bit of the debate around the politicization of what's happening in the field right now with the attack on sustainable investment, for just that reason, for trying to make an impact on society. And I think the next 5 years, there will be a grappling with, is talking about risks and opportunities to companies themselves sufficient? Is it sufficient for the field? Or do we have to be looking at that as well as the impact of companies on society? And so I feel like we've almost come full circle in this conversation that, you know, materiality has started to define the terms of the field. And I think there are now an increasing number of actors who are saying materiality is important for the work we do directly with companies and their own activities, but their own activities have immense impacts beyond the confines of their company walls. And so I think the next 5 years will be investors grappling with that question. What do we mean by investors truly addressing environmental, social, and governance issues? What is the scope? I think that's a big issue. One of the issues we've worked on a lot is how to get retirement plans in the United States to include sustainable investment options. One of the things I think about a lot is someone who didn't grow up in a family where we really talked about money and who was self-educated on finance, myself, before I got to USIF, and certainly have gotten an education while being there. But most high schools in this country do not even provide 1 or 2 weeks of training on basic budgeting and basic finance, let alone stock, bonds, mutual funds. So you have a fairly uneducated populace on finance in general. And then you add this idea of talking about sustainable investment. So one of the things I think needs to happen in the next 10 years, and it's not really the role of the field, is to better educate young people on how to be financially astute at even a basic level, so that when they're assessing financial decisions, sustainable investment is just an additional option for them. It's not trying to understand the basics of the field from the get-go. I think that's important. The reason I link that to retirement is that most Americans, at least, don't have a lot of discretionary income to invest in the stock market and a mutual fund and an ETF and the private markets. And so when they're investing, they're often investing through their retirement plans, if they're lucky enough to have one at their job. If the majority of retirement plans do not include one or more sustainable investment options, the ability to invest in sustainable investment funds, ETFs, et cetera, is very, very limited. And so to me, there's sort of a through line between how do you educate people to understand the basics of finance, and then how do you open up options for them in their jobs to be able to contribute to retirement plans that include these options. At USIF, we've been working for 10 years to get the Federal Thrift Plan, which is the largest retirement plan in the country, serves federal employees, to include sustainable investment options. And they just did that last year, which is a significant change, because now you've got folks at DOL or who can invest in companies that have better labor rights policies, or EPA who want to invest in companies that have a much better impact on the environment than, say, some of their former options. And so these are all really important changes that will allow more assets to flow into more sustainable funds.
That makes a lot of sense. Having the, you know, asset owners, those with the cash or inputting, applying pressure, or at least making informed decisions. Relating to sustainable investment. I want to come back to this point that you made earlier around materiality to the company versus materiality to society. And some would call this double materiality, thinking about materiality in both directions. Obviously, that's a question to grapple with, but what are some of the important aspects to consider in your experience? And I guess the backdrop to this question is that obviously we're seeing quite a bit of political debate right now around ESG. And if we think about the next 10 years and how to maximize, you know, results writ large to companies and to society, you know, what is the best way forward in your view?
I'm going to answer that around public policy first. And the reason I say that is public policy has been, was for USIF, and I'm sure will continue to be, a very important strategy for us, because we realized that without making changes at a systems level, which is also the reason we do a lot of work with media. We see media also as a potential systems changer as well, at least an educational changer that can drive systems change. That without looking at the policies that both, you know, surrounded the industry, but also addressed issues that the industry was most concerned with, and it's And for at least a decade, climate change has been the number one issue that investors are looking at in portfolios. And so doesn't it make sense to also be looking at climate policy and climate change disclosure, which we're still waiting for from the SEC? And so we really looked at that and said, there is a through line from investment to the systemic change that can happen through policy. So that's why we have worked on policy. The other piece of that, of course, is how do you get investors to work on policy, right? That's aligned with sustainable investment goals, as opposed to the Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, the Financial Services Roundtable, which may not have the same priorities as an organization like USCIF. That's been more challenging. The organization just had a Hill Day earlier this week, and people were so excited to go up to the Hill. Many people went to the SEC. They could see the link between what they did in their day jobs and what they were talking to members of Congress or their staff about. We need many more investors doing this. We need many more investors to make the link between the choices they're making in their portfolios, the choices they're making when they do shareholder engagement, and working on policy, whether it's at a local level, a state level, or the national level, because that more than anything will determine the investment environment we live in. So there's a lot of work to be done. I mean, I would say one of the things that I feel really does need to change is that investors really need to understand that when you're looking at environmental, social, and governance issues, it's equally important to look at how you can change those issues through the policy levers that you have available to you.
You know, one of the things that we've heard on previous podcasts is that with civil society, business, and government as main pillars of deciding the way we're going to operate together, it's so easy to point fingers and say, well, we'll move as soon as policy moves, or, you know, vice versa. And it sounds like part of what you're advocating for here is, well, you know, see the impact of your actions, engage in policy, not just in terms of the policies that you don't want to see, but also the policies that would make your job easier in pursuing sustainable investment. Does that sound right?
Yeah. And I mean, here's the thing. You can have a bunch of great companies paying more than the minimum wage, which, you know, in most states, at least in the U.S., is still really not enough to live on for a family, right? Or you can, at a policy level, mandate a higher minimum wage, you know, nationally. You can have companies work on climate, right? Or you can have a really robust climate change policy. These are all the things we need to think about. What's been interesting in some of the pushback a couple of years ago to the field, there was this critique that the very existence of sustainable investors meant that members of Congress and other policymakers did not think they needed to work on these issues, which I was dumbstruck by. There were a couple of spokespeople for this view, and I thought, you must never have spent any time in Congress or the State House, because Democrat, Republican, Independent, I have visited hundreds of offices over my time at USCIF. Never has a single person said to me, we're not working on climate, we're not going to work on housing, we're not going to work on minimum wage, because we know the sustainable investors will solve it. Never. I mean, believe me, had that happened, I would have remembered that. The other issue there, of course, is that assumes that these members of Congress or state legislatures know a lot about this field. And for the most part, they really don't. Part of what USCIF tried to do for so many years, and I'm sure we'll continue to do, is to be a consistent presence in those places to keep educating. You know, congressional members turn over, their staffs, mostly made up of young people, turn over. So even if you hit, say, someone from the 5th District of California in 2022, you better be there in 2023 and 2024, because the people may be different. And once the people leave with the knowledge, you've lost the knowledge. So I always did find that notion that Congress was really waiting for the sustainable investors, because I thought, I wish they knew enough about this field at such a deep level that they would even think that was possible.
One of the things that I've heard you say is that issues show up in investment when it's not dealt with at a national policy level. And it's really interesting to think about the belief that the inverse is true. Well, if, you know, investors are dealing with it, then policy isn't required. And it sounds what you're saying is we need all of the above to be working, and certainly a policy environment to support sustainable objectives.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm just a big believer that if you're in the business community in general, and you have a voice, whether you're in, you know, the corporate world, the investment world, you should use it. When we would go see members of Congress, they didn't even know there was a group of investors who were interested in social issues and environmental issues. They hadn't been hearing from them enough. And Democrat or Republican, they were quite interested to know that and to learn that and to try to learn some of what we could tell them about the field. And I just think it's very important, even at this moment when the allegations and the politicization, both at the state and the federal level, is happening, I still think it's very important to have a voice, you know, to speak the facts about the field and not to be intimidated by the anti-ESG folks who simply do not really understand how this works.
I want to get in a little bit deeper into that, Lisa, because, you know, in some cases, we're working, say, with private equity investors, and they're saying, well, we have some limited partners in Florida and other states where, you know, we're seeing statements come out and we have this program and it's adding value. But, you know, how do we keep this in mind, right? And I wanted to start with, I know that USCIF has spent some time with myth busting, but if there's one particular narrative that's gaining traction that you'd like to apply a little bit of data on or share a view on, would really welcome it at this juncture.
Well, the core, from my perspective, and from where funding is coming from for the anti-ESG messaging and campaign, first and foremost, starts with the fossil fuel industry. It's just the basic of it. And it's why they have gone after the Net Zero Alliance and other climate change alliances. Because of their, I think, probably financial connections to the fossil fuel industry, but also a deep desire that I don't fully understand, because they live in the same world that I live in, not to address climate change if it means that fossil fuel industry would, you'd see a diminution in any way by looking at alternative sources of power. And so that's where it begins. And once you understand that, you have to figure out how to respond to that. One of the things that I found really interesting about this campaign is they call it anti-ESG. One of the first things I said to our policy director when this happened was, who created their messaging? Because we don't call it ESG investing. No one knows what that is. I mean, ESG are criteria, data points, issues that are addressed in the investment process. We've never used the term ESG investing at USCIF. We've talked about sustainable investing. We've talked about impact investing. Back in the day, we talked about socially responsible investing. And so when you think of the public, what do they hear when they hear ESG investing? I think they hear nothing. If you had used the term sustainable, at least they'd get some image of something, maybe something green or something social. So the whole way the campaign has been pitched has been very interesting to me. But I think it picks up on this feeling in some parts of society that social policy is changing too much, that addressing racial justice, trying to get better company policies, creating more opportunities for women and people of color, that those are not things that they're happy about. And grabbing onto the anti-ESG in many ways for me is simply saying, we do not want to see forward movement on critical environmental and social policies in this country. And this is a way to do it.
It's a really interesting point that you bring up, following the money and understanding where the messaging is coming from. I guess, you know, some would argue that, you know, there's a fiduciary duty argument somewhere in this sphere. And I just wonder, you know, when you think about fiduciary duty, because obviously that's a top priority for the investors that you've spent the past 17 years working with, you know, how do you deal with questions around fiduciary duty and sustainable and responsible investing?
Well, there have been several hearings in Congress, and they've brought in state treasurers to talk about why this anti-ESG messaging doesn't make sense. Those folks are fiduciaries. You're a state treasurer. You're a fiduciary. And they very much feel like if they don't look at these issues in their portfolios, they are not looking at the long-term interests of their participants, for example, in their pension plan. And I agree with them. So the idea that state treasurers are risking or foregoing their fiduciary duty by assessing long-term systemic risks is nonsense. And I think multiple state treasurers have testified at these hearings and at others along those lines.
So Lisa, final question for you before we get into books. If you put yourself in the shoes of an investor that wants to lead in sustainable investment over the coming 5 years, what are some of the tools or lenses that you would apply or recommend applying?
If they're already established in the field, particularly at this moment, what I would want to see them doing is speaking out and writing and responding to these attacks. I think there has been a certain amount of a chill effect for some investors by the kinds of ways the anti-ESG community has gone after, say, BlackRock or some of the other funds that they've gone after. But I feel that we have 30 plus years of data, information, successes, where we can speak very calmly and candidly about what this process actually is, why climate change matters to investors and should matter to the end investors, of which all of these anti-ESG folks probably are an end investor in a pension plan, a retirement plan, their own mutual funds. And so I think this moment requires courage from leading investors and corporations to just speak facts in a very calm way to push back on it. So I think that's a very important baseline. And then I think to utilize are the same kind of tools that sustainable investors have been using for a long time. Good data, clear investment processes. I mean, one of the things the SEC is looking at is how do you ensure that funds that say they're using ESG or sustainability are actually doing that? How do we know? This is going to be, I believe, if a good rule emerges, the single biggest shift in our field for the last quarter century, because it will require funds that say in their prospectus, oh, we are totally focused on sustainability or ESG is part of all of our portfolios. How? Explain how. What ESG issues across what part of your assets? That will be game changing. And it will be important that the investment community supports a good rule, if it's a good rule, because it will put end investors and funds on an equal footing with equal requirements, and we will all know more, and that will be important.
Absolutely. Let's hope that that rule gets put in place where there's some sort of stick behind doing what one says they're going to do. Yeah. So on to the final question that I've been looking forward to discussing with you, Lisa. Yeah. I mean, obviously you've been leading in the sustainable investment space for quite some time. What have been some of the books that have really shaped the way you think?
It was such a good question. And I actually spent some time on this in terms of what kind of made me who I am, some of the books that influenced me. And where I kind of wanted to start is I really started out as a social policy anti-poverty person. This is where I directed my career after college. And one of the books that I love that really influenced me is a book called There Are No Children Here by Alex Kotlowitz, which is about two brothers trying to make it in a very, very challenging public housing project in Chicago. And I grew up outside Chicago. And this book, I have given it to so many people because I feel like it really gives people a sense of just how uneven our country is. And this notion that everybody has equal opportunity is flat out wrong. You have equal opportunity if you have equal footing, and we don't have equal footing in this country. And so the first part of my career, which was really about social policy, this book was a huge influence. I also look at the world largely through a feminist lens. And one of the kickoff books for this was a book called Woman at the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy, which I just gave to my 24-year-old son to read. He hasn't read it yet. And it was a fascinating book because it was kind of a science fiction, which I'm not a huge fan of science fiction in general, feminist book. And then I went on and got my master's in women's studies. So that was usually influential on me. And my frame for the world in many ways is through a feminist and social equity lens, I would say. And then for this job, the two books that I've read most recently that really were compelling, one of them was by Richard Powers called The Overstory. And he looked at the catastrophe, honestly, about the increasing decimation of forests and trees, and particularly old growth forests. And if you remember some of the stories, at least in the US, of people climbing into the tops of old growth canopy trees and chaining themselves there and refusing to let them be cut down, you read this book and it's about a dozen people who are responding to the destruction of these forests. And you start to feel quite radical about the importance of trees and the importance of forests and how devastating their devastation is, not just for us as people, but for biodiversity in general. I love that book. And then almost as a companion, I read a book called The Outlaw Ocean by Ian Urbina. And I actually got him to speak at our conference in 2022. And that looks at all of the things that happen on the ocean that we probably don't know about at all. Mass exploitation of migrant workers. Many of us in this field will be more familiar with issues like pollution and plastics, but also there's a boat that goes around that provides abortions offshore to countries where there are anti-abortion policies and women still need abortions. So that's like a chapter. And then there's a chapter, multiple chapters on migrant workers and their poor treatment, oftentimes death in the field. And then just multiple stories about the fact that the ocean is largely unregulated and ungoverned. And what does that mean? And it blew my mind because we think about ocean as, and we know about the plastic and we know about the lack of biodiversity and we know the pollution and we know we have limited time to stop the warming of oceans. This book takes you on a whole different journey and I loved it.
Lisa, I think that you just won the award for the best answer to that question. It is one of my favorite questions, and I'm there on the journey with you.
Yeah.
And just, it's been such a delight to speak with you today. Thank you for joining us on The Future in Sound.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you, Lisa, for joining us. You can learn more about her work by checking out the links in the episode description or by visiting re.co.com/thefutureinsound. The Future in Sound podcast is written and hosted by Jen Wilson and produced by Chris Attaway. This podcast is brought to you by Rico, a software as a services company helping clients to achieve resilient competitive advantage in the long term. If you enjoyed this podcast, really appreciate it if you wouldn't mind telling a friend about it. And even better, if you have a moment, rating us in your podcast app. Until next time, thanks for listening.